Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have a plant that ladybugs love.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Full circle.
Full circle. And some more information about the ladybug populations in North America and the United States. You know, the diversity, the issues. There are rare ones. There are way more ladybugs out there, people, than I think anybody ever realized.
And it's such a great name. The ladybug just conjures up this nice, lovable bug.
It does.
Everybody likes the ladybug.
Everybody does.
Loves
like
the ladybug. With reason.
With reason, indeed.
As it turns out.
And we'll find out more details on that. We've got Dr. John Losey. He is co-founder, in fact, of a project that's called the Lost Ladybug Project. It's part of Cornell University's entomology department and, you know, collaboration with some other folks, too. But they wanted to start tracking ladybug populations around the United States. So they got people involved, particularly students and young people, because they figured they would be sort of the perfect little ground warriors to look for ladybugs, right? Plus, it would teach kids a whole new scientific experience early in age. So it's a great project. I think I'm going to have to get involved because, Bob, I see ladybugs everywhere.
Yeah, I do too, but unfortunately, they're dying out like other things we need so mightily in the in horticulture, and we need to find out why and keep
and
track of those little guys.
Yeah, no kidding. So very interesting information coming our way with the Lost Ladybug Project and Dr. John Losey and our friend Tony Avent.
One of the great names in gardening, really horticulture, a real character in many, many ways. He's going to talk about the echinacea and the coneflower, basically, a very popular plant, 7 or 8 billion cultivars coming along these days. And Tony's going to sort them out for us.
And there's been some good crosses of echinaceas lately. And honestly, those end up being, they have in the past 5 years, my favorite types of coneflowers in the garden. And this year, they have done fabulously.
They might have too.
Just fabulously. So you'll want to stay tuned for that because it's a lot of good information on a plant, really a perennial plant that's super easy to grow and very rewarding. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, I try and keep track of at least half my promises and keep at least a quarter of them. And I was talking earlier, I think last fall, about losing my 130-year-old sugar maple tree in the front yard. I was going to make chainsaw benches out of it, chainsaw into benches. And the man that works for me has done that now. I've got these great benches. These trees were like 36 inches in diameter. He cut them up and made benches. I'm going to sit around in the yard to have part of my old tree around for the rest of my life.
That's true recycling, Bob.
Yeah, it is.
Or reusing.
And I really feel good about it, and I'll remember my tree that way, too.
Yeah. My tree got turned into mulch.
Well, much of this one did, too.
Yeah, okay, good.
But to have part of the benches around is fun.
Yeah, no
kidding. How about the Wish Estate? What's up?
I have been, the harvest is on, and, you know, it's funny. Whenever all the years passed, usually I harvest potatoes on the hottest day of the summer, you know, where the sweat beads are landing on you and sweat's dripping from you. But, you know, not this year. I had a beautiful day in which to do it. But I just wanted to remind everybody that when you're harvesting things like onions and potatoes and you have a goal of storage in mind, you need to actually harvest them at the right time, and then you need to cure them. You can't just, you know, it's a warning. People say, you know, why are all my potatoes sprouting or my onions rotting in a couple of months? Well, now's the time to take note of proper harvesting and curing. When it comes to onions, you want to wait until the tops flop.
Yep.
Because once they flop, that means that that onion neck has shrunk up. And those acids and all that stuff that's going on in the onion, I can't remember what they're called, phenolic acid or something, isn't that what it is?
It's a metaphor for old age.
Yeah, it shrinks up, so it seals the onion off, basically, so stuff can't get in there, and then it starts to rot. So once the tops flop, you can harvest your onions and then let them in the shade somewhere, good ventilation, let them cure for about 2 weeks.
Okay.
You can refrigerate them afterwards. When it comes to potatoes, you want the tops to die back completely and then wait about 10 days to 2 weeks. Leave them in the ground. They kind of harden off that way. Then when you dig them, you want to let them air dry in the shade, good ventilation for about 2 weeks, just like the onions. And then you can store them. It's better not to, and we learned this from Russ Parsons, How to Pick a Peach. It's better not to actually refrigerate potatoes because most refrigerators are too cold.
Yeah, I remember
because
that.
It changes.
Right.
the starch to more sugary, and you want a potato not to be really sweet is the problem.
Oh, they're so good when they're first dug.
Oh, they really are. Yeah. So if you can find, you know, a cool place in the basement, that's better. But yeah, let them cure or else they'll rot before you have a chance to eat them.
Good advice.
All right. That's what I've been working on the last couple of weeks. So getting everything ready for being stored in the basement. So.
And do you ever find ladybugs in your onions and potatoes?
I find so many ladybugs. And I'm delighted because it just tells me that I'm maintaining a healthy environment and not killing them with, you know, pesticides.
Yeah.
And I know that they're doing me a great service by eating a lot of pests that we don't want in the garden.
But there's a problem. We're getting less and less
ladybugs. There is a problem. And we can actually help to really determine that if we get involved with the Lost Ladybug Project. And we've got more on that. Dr. John Losey is with us. He's co-founder of the Lost Ladybug Project, and he's an entomologist at Cornell University. Dr. Losey is a part of a collaboration between Cornell, the USDA's Agricultural Research Station, and the National Science Foundation to identify ladybug populations across North America. John, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. Okay. My understanding is that it started back in 2000 with a handful of master gardeners there in New York State, some graduate students, and some kids. Can you talk about the concept and the inception of the whole project and what the goals were initially?
Yeah. So the basic idea is that we knew that some of our species of native ladybugs were declining, that ladybugs that were very common. In fact, some of the most common species 20 years ago were getting so rare that they couldn't be found anymore. And that all happened over a span of say, 15 years, which is a really fast decline for something that was once so numerous.
Mm-hmm.
And we also knew that a lot of the public liked ladybugs, but maybe didn't know the real importance of their role, both in agricultural and natural systems. And and the truth is, without ladybugs out there doing their jobs, we would just be overrun by pests that would eat plants, and we would find it very difficult to raise our crops. And in natural systems, they would just take over and kill off a lot of the trees and shrubs and wildflowers.
Mm-hmm. John, I think a lot of people also would be surprised that there's more than just one ladybug species out there. There's a great
many. Absolutely. And I think that is the one revelation that as people come to the project that we hear the most often is that, oh, I thought they were all just ladybugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out there are like 750 species of ladybugs in the U.S., and they all do their jobs in a slightly different way. Maybe they forage on a different part of the plant, or they are in different fields, or they're out at different times. And so it's not like we can just lump them all together. They as a group have an important job to do, but they all do that job a little bit differently.
Why ladybugs? Is there a gentleman bug somewhere?
The term ladybug comes from, in the old days, farmers had some idea that it was the ladybugs that would eat the pests that were eating their crops, but they didn't really know about the sort of ecological relationship. So when they saw pests in their crops, they would pray to the Virgin Mary, which is our Lady. And so ladybugs became, or those beetles became the beetles of Our Lady. And later that was shortened to ladybugs or lady beetles.
So they're all Catholic.
They are actually beetles. That's right, yeah.
That's interesting. So yeah, continuing on with like the importance of and the goal of the whole project, trying to get a handle on what species are common, what species are rare, And how to bring that all back into balance, huh?
Exactly. And one of the sort of science side, one of our goals is just to see what ladybugs are out there now. Because even in most of the books that we have, if you looked in a book and said what insects or what ladybugs are there in Kentucky or what ladybugs are in New York, it's probably not going to be quite right because they've shifted so rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so for farmers to know how to make the right decisions as to what they can expect from the ladybugs or when they might have to spray or for a naturalist to know what he might encounter if you were going out on a hike, you need to have some idea of what ladybugs are out there. Mm-hmm. The problem is there are so many ladybugs, and they're shifting so rapidly across such a wide area that there's just not enough of us trained entomologists to go out there and sample enough to get a handle on what's happening. Mm-hmm. And so our two goals, and they sort of fit together, are both to teach people about the importance of ladybugs and other beneficial insects, to sort of show them that science isn't some magic thing that happens in an ivory tower, that they can actually do science themselves, and to find out the data on what's happened to these rare ladybugs. Are they going extinct? What ladybugs are out there now? Where do we still find the rare ones? And what can we do to keep other species from going down this same path where mm-hmm. they've gone from being very common to now very, very rare.
So that
was really the idea behind the uh-huh. project.
So 15 years, you said, pretty dramatic shifts in the population numbers and just the shifting of, I guess, where they show up, right? So what mm-hmm. are the assumptions about why this was, you know, why this has happened so quickly?
The bottom line is at this point we don't really know why they declined so rapidly. But one of the things that we do know is that at the same time that they were just beginning to decline, some of the foreign ladybugs were introduced.
Okay.
And all the foreign ladybugs in the U.S. were, and there's about 25 species, were actually introduced on purpose. There's none mm-hmm. that came over here by accident, like a lot of pests do. Mm-hmm. And so some of the, there's a close cousin of one of the rare ladybugs that was brought in from Europe, and it started to really spread and become numerous at the same time that some of the native ones started to decline. And so we think there may be a link there between those two things. What that link is exactly, we don't know. Did it introduce a disease? Is it just better at eating so many aphids that there's none left for the native ones? Uh-huh. And yeah, so we're that's what we're trying to find out now.
Well, John, why were they introduced?
Well, the idea was that ladybugs do have such a different way of doing things, is that if you already have the native ones and they're doing a great job, but you could bring in these foreign ones and they would just help out, and then you would have even more pest suppression mm-hmm. Than you do now. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, in certain systems like soybean, it seems like the foreign ones are really contributing and doing a good job. In other systems, it seems like maybe we've just had a switch, and so you've got different ladybugs, but you're really getting the same sort of pest suppression that we got before.
And this foreign bug is the one we find in our houses now in the winter all the time, just on warm walls. There's billions of them in my house.
Yes. So the most common ladybug that we find, and in fact, through our project, almost a third of all the ladybugs that we find are the multicolored Asian ladybug. Mm-hmm. And it's called multicolored because it can have all kinds of different spotting patterns on its back. Mostly ladybugs, you can tell what it is by its spots, but this one has a lot of different patterns. And unlike all of the native ladybugs that spend the winter outside, usually at the base of trees, this one foreign ladybug, this Asian ladybug, actually comes into people's houses.
Talk some about the life cycle of the ladybug. How does that fit in this whole problem? You know, when do they reproduce? How do they reproduce? How many and so forth?
Well, ladybugs, like all insects, start out as eggs. And so they will overwinter as adults. They spend the winter as adults. They sort of hibernate like bears do. And then they wake up again in the spring. And pretty quickly they mate and lay eggs, and then those will hatch out into what we call larvae, which don't mm-hmm. look anything like the adults.
No, they
and
don't.
If you hadn't seen them, you probably wouldn't. To us, we think they look sort of like little alligators.
That's what I think they look like too. That's how I describe them to people.
Uh-huh. Yep. Mm-hmm. They have little pointy tails, uh-huh. and they've got sort of bigger heads, and they've got the six legs off to the side.
Yeah.
And so then they'll eat a lot of aphids, or and they also eat mealybugs and scales and little caterpillars if they're out there, and then they pupate just like a butterfly, except they don't form a cocoon; they just sort of form a little chrysalis, and then those will come out and be adults. And one of the other misconceptions is you'll see a small ladybug already having its spots, and somebody will say, "Well, that's a baby one." And really, it's an adult. It's not going to get any bigger. It's just that some species and some individuals are smaller than others.
Okay. So if we're in our backyard, and we'll get to the details of how people can participate in the Lost Ladybug
Great.
Project, but if I want to start honing my skills in terms of identifying ladybugs or, you know, monitoring them at least, where should I be looking for them? You know, what times of the day are, you know, you mentioned that different species do different things in different places, different times of the day. So where should I start my search, and what should I take note of?
Well, what we always tell people is if you ever see a plant that has some sort of aphid or scale or mealybug on it, that's really your best place to start looking, because you can always find ladybugs around their food. And another way to look is sometimes you can see ants on a plant. And often if you see ants on a plant, they're there because they're tending the aphids. They like to eat the honeydew that the aphids secrete.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be a good place. If you follow the ants, sometimes you can find the aphids and then find the ladybugs. But in a more general sense, any place that you find lushly growing plants, and those can be either like a crop, maybe it's like alfalfa or soybean, or it could be just a meadow or an old field. Any place that you can find those sorts of plants, you can go out and either just look with your naked eye, or you can get what we call a sweep net. And it's easy to make these. You could just take a stick, a coat hanger, and a pillowcase, and we've got directions on the website on how to do this. You don't have to spend $30 or $40 for it, although you can get a really nice one, but you can make your own, and you go through and you sweep in this vegetation, and if it's during the summer and not the late summer when it gets dry, most likely you'll come up with some ladybugs.
Are there certain times of the day that are better to do your sweep net cast?
We tend to find that earlier in the day and then evening are good times to do. I mean, you can find ladybugs at any time of the day, but especially sort of late afternoon and evening tends to be a good time.
Mm-hmm.
If you go too early and there's a lot of dew, then that's tougher because the sweep net gets soaked.
In terms of the, it's been 9 years since you guys have been collecting the information, what's the picture look like in terms of how many rare species have you found, and, you know, are numbers on the upswing for some of those? What are the most common ones we may find, that sort of thing?
Our project is, you can sort of think of it in two phases, and we have been going since the sort of turn of the century at some level, but then last May, we got funding from the National Science Foundation, and that really helped us sort of ramp up the program.
Sure.
And just since that time, the people that are out there looking through the project have found more of the rare species of ladybugs than me and my fellow scientists have found and published on in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept has really worked well, in that if you get people excited about it, and especially kids, that are going to go out and look all the time in all these different places, we are going to come up with these rare species. And so we have found numerous sightings. I think there's three species that are really rare. There's the nine-spotted ladybug, which is Coccinella novum notata. That's our state symbol in New York.
Oh,
it doesn't occur here anymore, apparently. There's the transverse ladybug, which has sort of stripes across its back instead of spots.
Wow.
And there's the two-spot ladybug.
Mm-hmm.
And we've found multiple sightings of all of those species. We're now we're in double digits of different places where people have found those just since the last year and a half. And not only have we been able to sight where they are, but a young girl in Oregon, Allison Yates, found some of the nine spot in her backyard, and so she submitted these to the project. She didn't even know what she had at the time.
Submitted photos, not the actual ladybugs.
That's right, and so the key is we're looking for photos. We don't really want people to send
no
us
specimens,
live
please,
because mostly they're dead by the time we get them.
Sure.
And so we were able to go out to Oregon and collect with her and her family, and we were able to bring back the nine-spot ladybug. So for the first time in New York, now we have a, in the lab still, mm-hmm. we have a breeding population of this rare ladybug, and it's the first time it's been in New York for over 20 years.
Right. So that's a good story, good news. So, John, let's talk about it. You mentioned the children that were involved in identifying these ladybugs. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of the project, really, encouraging children to be involved, and not just because, oh, it's fun to go and identify ladybugs, but the long-term effect that exposure to science and emphasis on biodiversity may have on our younger generation.
Absolutely. Our idea is really that it's twofold, that we can really make a difference both through the data that we collect, and we absolutely need help to gather that data, but then we can also make a difference through teaching people about the importance of biodiversity and conservation. And this idea that you can learn about the process of science. And I've, throughout my teaching career, been a big proponent that I've never liked exercises where you go out at any level, where you go out and it's all preset, and if you do steps A, B, and C, you know, we know exactly what you're going to find, and if you don't find that, you did it wrong. and in this case, we have a program where kids can go out in their own backyard, they can do something relatively simple, but they are actually putting in data, which they can see, like within a week, is already posted on our database, that they're taking part in this big experiment, mm-hmm. which is really important.
And there's nothing done wrong.
And so it sort of demystifies mm-hmm. the science.
Sure. So what are the kids doing? They're going out, they find a ladybug, they don't send in the live specimen.
We've
established that.
Correct.
they take a picture of it, and then they go through what, a process that you all have on the web?
Yep.
To enter the
data?
So
we have it's an online submission form. So if you go to it's www.lostladybug.org, mm-hmm. and all the information on how to collect, and then there's one page that's the online submission form, and you answer a series of questions. What day did you go out? How long were you collecting? What was the weather like? What plant did you collect it on? And then there's a place where you've already hopefully put the picture on your computer. Mm-hmm. You can browse for that, and you hit send, and that sends it to our straight to our database. One of us that works here identifies it, and we post it on the database, and then hopefully within it's probably now a couple of weeks, but once we're trying to streamline that within a few days, then it's on the official database. So to be an official data point, we need to have an image that we can identify to species.
Okay. I'll submit some stuff because I see ladybugs all the time. So
fantastic. We'll look forward to that.
I'll play Lost Ladybug with you as well. Sounds good.
Oh, good.
Thank you, John. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed being on the program.
Great. Dr. John Losey is one of the co-founders of the Lost Ladybug Project and an entomologist at Cornell University. He spoke to us from their campus studio in Ithaca, New York. And of course, for more information on the Lost Ladybug Project and how you can get involved, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, Tony Avant tells us all about coneflowers. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug.
Shrubs. Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug. There are 5,000 species worldwide. Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug. The number of spots identifies the kind. Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug. Smell, touch, and taste things. Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug. Ladybugs chew from side to side.
Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug.
If it's cold or dark, not fly.
Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug. Important jobs.
Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug.
Eating aphids that destroy our crops.
Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug.
We need lots of different kinds.
Ladybug, ladybug, ladybug.
Some species are now hard to find.
Ladybug, ladybug.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And you know, Bob, you know how I love my prairie and all that, and yeah. How I love my perennial garden. I have, in fact, been collecting a great many of the new echinaceas that have hit the market over the last decade or so.
I am not surprised.
So I have had experience growing well or not so well some of the plants that we're about to talk about.
You're an echinacea kind of woman.
So we're going to find out a little bit more about the echinacea in its old form and in its new form. Tony Avon is joining us now. Tony Avon is a plant explorer, breeder, and nurseryman who owns Plant Delights Nursery in Raleigh, North Carolina. They offer an unusual collection of plants, also hard to find garden perennials, through mail order primarily, including about a dozen different varieties of echinacea. Tony's joining us to sort through the story behind all these coneflowers and which varieties are best for Kentuckiana. Tony, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
Great. I think this is probably the third, fourth, fifth time you've been on Homegrown with us.
I think he's the all-time holder now.
And we're delighted to have you back. It used to be that the only coneflower available to gardeners was the basic purple coneflower, Echinacea purpura. What happened over the years that sort of turned this plant into something that, I guess, plant breeders were really looking at to come up with new selections?
Well, it's interesting how plants become the flavor of the month, mm-hmm. we call it, in gardening, and echinacea certainly have gone really in the last 10 years from what were seed strains you could get in the purple and white. The first one really happened with a seed strain out of Georgia that got given to a college classmate of mine, Kim Hawks, who mm-hmm. had a place called Niche Gardens.
And, yeah, right.
And Kim found one that was really nice in there that had reflex petals and was a little shorter than normal. And she approached the folks up in Connecticut at Sunny Border Nursery about tissue culturing. Now, tissue culture had never been done on echinacea, which means that's just plant cloning. You know, that's legal in all states but South Carolina. And so they were able to actually clone that one, and that was the first ever cloned plant of echinaceas. Well, people got looking like, wow, you know, if we could clone that, what else would be the possibilities? And they began looking, and the only way to really get unique colors in was to bring in the Midwest native Echinacea paradoxa. The paradoxa is a 5 foot tall, it's a very lanky plant, little mm-hmm. sort of spindly, but has yellow flowers. And so original work was done up at Chicago Botanic Gardens, a fellow named Dr. Jim Alt, and he began breeding, and he based his using paradoxa and Echinacea tennesseensis, which gave it a narrower leaves and a different type form. And almost at the same time, another breeding program began down in Atlanta, a fellow named Richard Saul of Saul Nursery. And he began breeding, same background, except he used purpurea with his paradoxa. And almost simultaneously, they came up with two different lines.
Huh.
The
Alt
line had more narrow petals and was taller, whereas the Saul line was a shorter plant with wider petals.
Hmm.
And so both of these really hit the market about the same time, and that's all thanks to the understanding of how to tissue culture echinaceas.
Wow. So how many different species of echinacea are there?
Oh, there's quite a few different ones. A lot are actually endangered. Mm-hmm. In North Carolina, we have the endangered Echinacea lavigata. You have everything from Mangustifolia to Purpurea to Paradoxa and on and on. There really is quite a few species. And most of them don't have great commercial value because on many, especially the endangered ones, the petals are very narrow. And they're just not what most people would consider good garden plants. Mm-hmm. So they're really two or three good species. Tennesseeensis, which is a very rare, it's actually federally endangered, that is a great garden plant.
Mm-hmm.
It forms a nice rosette, blooms for, it makes a nice perennial plant. Mm-hmm. So there are some good species, and the key was just getting them all to get them in the same room and sort of have a plant orgy, and it's created some really neat things.
So essentially the difference between, if I can get the nomenclature right, the plants that came out of Chicago Botanic Garden are considered Chicagoland series?
Yeah.
And then the ones from down south at Itzhall are considered what? Do they have sort
I
of a category?
The Cone Crazy series.
Cone Crazy series. Okay, so the essential difference is Paradoxa with Purpurea and then Paradoxa with Tennesseeensis.
That's correct. I think all of them have got some other species in it, but
those are the main species.
In each of the lines, and that's where the lines really differ.
Mm-hmm.
It's turned out for garden use that the Itzhall series have proven much better in wider parts of the country than the Chicagoland series.
Mm-hmm.
They're really being sold now all over the world, and interestingly, a lot of the tissue culture now on all of these is done in New Zealand.
Probably done.
Yeah, there is some done in America, but New Zealand labs are really doing the majority of the numbers, so it's quite fascinating. We have a native plant that goes over to down under to get reproduced and then get sent back to the U.S. to be grown and sold.
Hmm.
Yeah, a little footnote, Tony. As you know, the Kim's plant became what, Kim's Knee High?
Uh-huh.
Because
it
was a dwarf one. Some of the names are really cool. Is that still out there and going pretty well?
It is still out there. What was interesting, it actually, Kim's not particularly vertically endowed, and when the plant came back out of tissue culture, it actually was taller than her knee, and she got a little upset, but it's still a great plant. And what happens often when you go into tissue culture, you clean up diseases, maybe even viruses,
mm-hmm.
and often the plant is more vigorous than when it went into tissue culture, so that's a good thing. And what's interesting now is everybody around the world who's had an interesting echinacea is all of a sudden starting to put them all on the market at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're finding in breeders in Germany. There's a new series coming out of England, the Double Delight series. There's a pink Double Delight, which is really nice. There's a great double out of Holland called Razzmatazz, which has a really neat story. The fellow had selected it and had multiplied it and had a field full. He was growing it for the cut flower industry. So he took it to the big auction house where all the cut flowers are sold, and nobody liked it.
Oh, no.
And he was so upset, he came home and jumped on his tractor, began plowing up his field, and it just so happens that two nurserymen drove by, and they saw this, and they stopped, and they said, "Please stop, get off your tractor, stop plowing these up." And he told them the story, and they wound up buying the entire field and introduced it under the name Razzmatazz to the nursery industry.
Yeah, describe that one, because it's an amazing plant.
It's really neat. It's a double. It's like the center part is like a little cone of cotton candy, and then the pink petals around it. It was really revolutionary in the industry, and that's sort of the breeding line of the pink Double Delight, which is a very similar flower that's sort of double pink, but it has many more flower stems and flowers over a longer period of time.
Since that one looks, in terms of the flower, is so distinctive, because it is kind of fantastical looking, kind of weird looking. Was that a freak of nature, Tony, or were they able to develop that through crossbreeding?
That was actually a freak of nature that just popped up, and the guy said, "Oh, this is really interesting." And people now are looking to breed. There's actually a seed strain out that produces a sort of a double flower, and this one is actually pretty ugly. It's called Doppelganger, and sometimes it'll have an extra set of petals on the top, and I can't say I would have introduced that. I like most plants, but that one's pretty ugly. now, the really interesting trait that's come into echinaceas came in through probably the latest member of the breeding group, and that's the folks out at Terra Nova in Oregon. Mm-hmm. They made a selection out of a strain that was grown over in Europe, and they introduced one called Ruby Giant, which has 4.5 to 5 inch flowers.
Wow.
And the neat thing about it that they didn't realize when they introduced it is it is fragrant.
Oh.
And that's a trait that's in Echinaceas, but it's never really been selected for. Mm. So they introduced this Ruby Giant. Turned out it was fragrant. When they found out, they went back and bred it, and they produced one of my favorite, which is a white flowered one called Fragrant Angel, which is it reblooms all summer. It's got very large 4-inch white flowers and wonderfully fragrant.
Wow.
So they've now got their own line of Echinaceas coming out.
And something that stands out like, specifically for them, too, with that fragrance.
Yeah, exactly. So, and they're bringing the colors in now. So you've really got three different lines now in the U.S. and then the line coming out of England. So really four breeders, and I understand there are some more in Germany getting started. So we're gonna have Echinaceas out the ears too much longer.
Well, Tony, talk a little bit about the general culture of the plant. And you mentioned cutting them back. Can they get them to rebloom 2 or 3 times during a season if you keep doing that?
Yeah, Echinaceas, as a rule, are prairie plants. And what that generally tells us is they're very drought tolerant. They, as a rule, don't like to be crowded by other plants. They really like their space, like it open. They generally like very bright sun. As the flowers get larger and double, you have to give those sun and good air movement. If you don't, the stems will be weak and tend to fall over. So just like anything, you want to water them well when they're getting established. But once they're established, they are just amazingly drought tolerant. Soils need to be well drained. That's really the key. About the only way you could do a good job killing Echinaceas is very wet, soggy soils in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned earlier in our conversation that some plants, the cone crazy, the southern itzel ones, were a little more widely adaptable than the Chicagoland series. And I have actually had that experience. I've had I've suffered some losses, as it were, with some of the Chicagoland series, unfortunately. So can you talk a little bit about, or do you know why that occurs, in fact, and which ones are going to be best for Kentuckiana gardens, Tony, since we're, you know, pretty much zone 6?
Well, it's not a winter hardiness problem.
Okay.
It's more of a moisture in the wintertime.
Okay.
And what happens when a new genus of plant starts getting bred, everybody's in a rush to get them out, which means most people probably don't trial them in a wide range of conditions as well as we would like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, this is a classic example of these. The Chicago ones did great in the soils there in Chicago. Well, once they moved out of Chicago, they didn't do particularly as well as they had there in the garden. So it really is more of getting some out and trialing them. I know a couple of the early Sol series did not do as well.
Mm-hmm.
My favorites so far out of that group are one called Sunrise, which is yellow,
yeah, right.
And then a beautiful orangish brown one called Evan Sol.
Mm-hmm.
And those so far are the best two. Sundown, Sunset did not trial as well with us, but the Sunrise and then the Evan Sol are the best. The other ones we just haven't had in long enough to give a good long-term evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tony, you've got like a dozen of them in your catalog at Plant Delight Nursery. Give us some other favorites you have that work for you and that might work for us.
Well, like I say, both of those two I would rule as exceptional. I certainly like the Ruby Giant and the Fragrant Angel. Those have proven over a long period of time to be just absolutely excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the new ones are looking really good. The problem that confuses people is a lot of the nurserymen are doing this very bizarre double naming plants where
right.
they give it two different names. One
right.
is totally meaningless, and that really confuses people. And Echinaceas have, unfortunately, for some bizarre reason, got the same problem. So you need to be careful when you're looking to make sure you're getting the right ones. Katie Saul is looking real good in our trials so far. That's another out of the Saul program. I think you're going to see the Saul stuff looking real good. So far, the Pixie Metabrite, that's one of the latest out of Chicago, is looking good. That's actually a dwarf.
Anything that's going on just at the at Plant Delights at the nursery for you? Anything new and exciting that you've been focused
beyond
on this
echinacea?
Year?
What do you got? Yeah. Something stored away there?
Oh,
for sure.
Oh my goodness, we got so much. It's hard to even remember it all.
Yeah.
But, you know, for us, it's all about trialing the plants, seeing which ones really grow well, because that gives us so much more information than just, you know, throwing it out there without finding out if it's really as good as the breeder said. Because if you ask a breeder, everything they introduce is great.
Right.
Yeah, well, I'd mentioned earlier that I think you have something like 18,000 plants in your trial garden or around
your
house.
Yeah, we're within about 100 of the 18,000 mark now. So it's we got a lot of plants to trial, and it's a lot of neat things. And for us, it's just about making sure they're going to be good garden plants, making sure they're not going to be invasive, which fortunately we don't have to worry about with the echinaceas, and then hopefully figuring out how to get them propagated after that. So it's a slow process on some plants. I know people see things in the garden and they want it yesterday. Well, that's not the way things work in plants.
Right.
It takes a while, and just like these echinaceas, have taken years to develop. Good plants, just like good wine, is worth waiting for.
Indeed.
And you do allow the public in a couple days a year, right, to come see your stuff?
We do. We actually open up four times a year. We do a two-weekend open house in the dead of winter. We do one in spring, one in summer, and one in fall. So love to have people, if they're making a trip out this way, they can find the dates and times on our website at plantdelights.com. And display gardens are pretty extensive. We'd love to have them come visit.
Sounds good. Great. Thanks a lot, Tony. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
As always.
Tony Avon owns Plant Delights Nursery in Raleigh, North Carolina, where you can find unusual and hard-to-find garden perennials. The nursery is primarily a mail-order nursery, but you can visit during seasonal open houses or scheduled visits. Plant Delights offers about a dozen echinacea varieties, so you can check out their website, of course, by visiting our website, learn a little bit more about the nursery and about echinacea.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob, the questioner Hill here.
All right. You want to start?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Go ahead.
A great question from Lisa, because it's an old problem and a nice problem in a way. And she's got an old rose bush, and she wants to, from her father's home, she wants to keep an heirloom rose bush going. She knows there's a lot of different techniques for taking cuttings and keeping this thing going to the next generation. Does she start slips indoors? Should she use a glass jar and cover it? Should she use potting soil and peat, or just soilless mix? What do you think?
Yeah, she said she's done some research on the internet, and those are some of the different suggestions. And I would do all of the above just to increase your chances of making sure that you're met with success. She's got a limited period of time at the house because it's being sold. So she can't do the layering thing. And you know, we've done that before, where you kind of take a branch down, put a brick on it or a sod pin or something like that, and it actually roots out into the soil all by itself.
Like a little cutting in the bottom,
It's called layering, which is great, but she can't do that since the property's, you know, going to be sold. So what she's going to want to do is take softwood cuttings. So basically the relatively new kind of succulent growth that's on the shrub right now, take several, I mean, I take a half a dozen cuttings at least, and you can stick them in like a little tray of soilless potting mix, which is basically like peat and vermiculite, and use some rooting hormone as well. There's stuff called Root Tone.
Yes.
And you'll, what, Bob? How, she wants like cuttings that are about, what, 6 inches,
yeah,
5 inches,
6 inches?
4 to 6 inches.
Yeah.
Not real tall.
No.
Strip the leaves off the side, stick it in there in the rooting hormone, and then stick it in your light mix. Keep that moist, and it should root out in a matter of a month or so. Then you can transplant those into smaller pots, you know, with some soil, and keep bumping them up as they grow. And you can keep them indoors if you want. I would keep them outside somewhere just so that they can, you know, shaded and all that.
Make
sure they don't dry out, just because the humidity will help them. But in the wintertime, you'll probably want to bring them in because they won't quite be hardened off by then. And treat them as a house plant, but understand that you don't want them too wet. You don't want them too dry. You don't want to keep a glass jar on top of them by any means once they get to a certain point, because you'll just bake them.
And I use I'll use like plastic and make a little tent.
Yeah.
And carefully like moist it, even mist it a little bit, not too wet. It's kind of tricky for a while, but she'll have good luck.
But you don't want to have that on after they reach a certain point of maturity, like in the house. So that's why outside might be a good option, because you'll have that natural sort of humidity level too. So, but
unfortunately, the
more cuttings you take, the better success you're likely to have.
You just need one.
That's right. All right, here's one another question, Bob. This one's from Ellen. She says, "Hi, I have a Quezon cherry tree that I planted in 2007. It's been thriving, but recently I noticed several splits on the bark. What do you think is causing this? Is there anything I can do about it?"
That's kind of the nature of the beast, really, with a cherry tree. I've had splits on mine over the years, and it didn't hurt the tree at all. It lived just fine. We were just kind of guessing, really, if it was the residual effect of the ice storm, or maybe you were thinking maybe a frost from a couple of years ago might have even done some damage to it.
Because different things can happen and like kill the cambium layer of trees. And since it was planted in 2007, and in fact that was the hard freeze year, there could have been some damage to its vascular system, if you will, and then the cambium layer would have died. And then as the tree grows, that becomes apparent in some of those splits. Ice pressure can also cause certain splits to form. It just sort of depends on where the splits have been. Growth spurts, all the rain that we had this spring, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
Trees grew well.
Way
that?
Too well, almost.
So it could have had, you know, sort of like how tomatoes crack. It could have had a little bit more of a growth spurt than its cambium was up for, if you will. But it's not... For cherries, it's not really that unusual. If I've, you know, crab apples and other types of things, same thing. Not unusual to see some splits starting to form as time goes on.
Just keep an eye on it, and it should be fine, really.
Yeah, just keep it healthy, generally speaking. Yeah. There's nothing else to do about it. So,
if you have a question for Dr. Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 502-814-8246.
Well, Bob, it's a plant story day. What is it?
Calycarpa japonica.
Aha. Beautiful berry.
You got it, the beauty berry.
Beauty berry.
It's one of my favorite fall plants. It's just a beautiful fall shrub, as you know. It's kind of a bit of an ugly duckling because it sits there all summer, doesn't do much, and then all of a sudden, September and October, it's just covered in these metallic purple berries. It's just beautiful. It'll get like 4 feet tall, 6 feet tall. I like the flowers, too, the kind of light lavender, whitish flowers are kind of fun to have. But it's the berries that win the show at the end of the year. It's just great. The name comes from two Greek words, kalos, or beautiful, and karpa, or...
berry.
You got it. Yep. Beautiful berry, yeah. Of course, it's japonica, so it's a native of Korea, Asia, Japan. Some of them are, anyway. It made its way to the West in 1845. Jefferson, of course, had it at Monticello, at everything. The folklore is kind of neat, too. Supposedly, the Native Americans use it as a mosquito repellent. It was kind of a...
They a native think, species?
Well, yeah, and they thought it was true, or nobody really believed it, until the University of Mississippi did a test and found out, yes, indeed, had two chemicals that chased away mosquitoes.
But a different species than the japonica one? Or
yeah,
that
the
one
Native American.
Okay.
Yeah, they had it right. Calycarpa, there's several different kinds. Calycarpa americana is the native here. It gets 8 or 10 feet high, kind of wild. I don't like that one very much. Then there's the Calycarpa bodonerii. The one called Profusion, I don't have good luck with.
Yeah.
It's got the purple berries, but it gets real tall and gangly. But the Calycarpa dichotoma, the purple beauty berry, is the one
I like
the most.
That's the one to grab up.
Yep. There's several different cultivars. The early amethyst, which is just this beautiful, beautiful berries. The Isai is another great plant. A new one I just got this year called Duet. It's a variegated Calycarpa. I can't wait
Sounds
to see
dreadful.
The berries. Well, I know. Actually, that was my first thought because it's got this beautiful kind of whitish leaf, and then here comes a purple berry. It might be neat.
Yeah.
We're going to find out.
I'll give it a chance.
But you don't sound too convinced of this. But it comes with a deeply philosophical poem.
Excellent.
Memory sweet we hold of September, days and nights we all remember. Ancient times so free of worry, clean and bright as the beauty berry. But nostalgia is not what it used to be. As we assemble the family tree, the endless struggle to reach fruition, and then the rise in college tuition. So let me get this off my chest. The victory is in the quest, as through the world we push and hurry in ever pursuit of the beautyberry.
Excellent. And a wonderful plant to boot.
It is.
But you'll have to let me know about that variegated one.
Okay? I will. I'll send you pictures.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, a tour of a couple of old Louisville gardens and how to chuck a woodchuck.
The Homegrown Purple Prose is lovingly edited by Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. And special thanks this week to the Cornell University Media Production Group. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.